Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me, Ibrahim Sani. Now, the death toll in China has reached 132 from the novel coronavirus, with the number of confirmed cases on Wednesday reaching nearly 6,000. The World Health Organization has acknowledged that China is in the midst of a medical emergency, but it said last week that it was too early to declare the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern. Now, it has described the global risk from the virus as high. Let's now take a wider view of what it takes for governments and global agencies to coordinate outbreak response policies. We have joining us via Skype Dr. Kaw Swee King. He's a physician and global health expert at University of Oxford in the UK. Dr. Kaw, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Now, you recently wrote an article on the politics of the coronavirus outbreak, in which you make the point that these outbreaks are becoming increasingly more common here in Asia specifically. Now, the SARS epidemic in 2003 that we saw, as well as the H1N1 flu pandemic in 2009. Now, my question is, given that we've had this experience, is the world better equipped this time around, having learnt those lessons from 2003 and 2009?
Melissa, pleasure to be here. We are in some ways better equipped versus 2003 and 2009, and in some ways worse equipped. Let's talk about the worse equipped one first. The population is larger, it's increasingly urbanized, and because of this, we're increasingly encroaching onto various areas of virgin farmland, and we're interacting a lot more with animals and vectors. I think on a second level as well, the world is less prepared for this because there's so much travel, including the use of social media, where news travels often so much faster. So while outbreaks will happen quite frequently, the way we respond to outbreaks indicate the resilience of human societies as well. And in some cases, trust in governments has reduced to such an extent that governments cannot marshal an appropriate response. So in some ways, we've not learned those lessons. But in some ways, in other ways, Melissa, I think the world is doing much better. Let's talk about the speed of which science is accelerating. To decode the genome for SARS in 2003, it took us approximately 4 months. However, scientists in China decoded the genome for the novel coronavirus in only 8 days. So our capacity to decode this genome and also to manufacture the vaccine and perhaps even to discover the vaccine in the first place, all that would increase. The second piece of good news, I guess, is the international collaboration that's taking place at the moment at the informal level between scientists, but also at the global level, because lots of governments and heads of state are increasingly focused on outbreaks as an important part of their policies. So in some ways, we have learned, and in some ways, we've not learned the lessons from 2003 and 2009.
Dr. Kaw, I just want to chime in on the emotional factor here, because while the doctors are doing enough, or the government is doing a lot in terms of trying to get the public support in this, there seems to be a lot of fear, a lot of panic. You were among the people that published the consortium of organizations asking for calm. How do we manage that emotional factor here, the fear factor that a contagion or an outbreak is normally associated with?
Thanks, Ibrahim. Ibrahim, some of the causes for the fear are very understandable. We want to protect ourselves and our health and also our family. And there's also a very understandable element that we don't have all the facts. If we can accept that the fear is real, but it's manageable and governments are doing everything that we can, that's one good step. The second cause of the fear, really, is a lack of information. But over here as well, there's a challenge because new facts will continue to come up. Indeed, the virus is evolving and perhaps even mutating as we speak. But as I say this, we're also devoting tremendous amounts of resources in terms of human people researching the subject. Also, a lot of money is being put in to discover the science behind this. So those are the two main reasons why people are panicking out of a real fear, and secondly, they don't have enough information. One thing that we can do, there are several things that we can do, Ibrahim, and the first thing I imagine is that we must be trusting the information that comes from the official sources of our government. In this case, in Malaysia's case, the official channels of the Ministry of Health. Secondly, we must be very judicious in the use of social media. Thirdly, if we're burdening the Ministry of Health's outbreak response with unnecessary emotions, we're taking them away from the actual task of managing the outbreak and asking them to utilize energy to manage the emotions of human beings. Mm. while I think that this is understandable why human beings feel this way, I think we should also be a little bit more calm, and that is why we issued that open letter, a response, a statement by 12 professional associations.
Well, I thought that letter was quite a soothing balm for many of us who have concerns about the spread of this virus. And I want to touch a little bit on that, the role of public health physicians and epidemiologists in containing not just the outbreak, but also this alarmist spread within the public. Can you comment a little bit on the role of public health physicians?
Of course. Public health is an extremely broad field, and in the space of outbreak responses, they are one of many stakeholders or many team members inside the team. So obviously we need virologists, scientists, mathematicians, modeling experts, we need doctors and the frontline staff as well. So they are part of an entire team. The epidemiologist is a function, or rather a subset of the broader public health. So there are many functions inside public health, and epidemiology is one of them. What does an epidemiologist do? They use statistics, mathematics, and biology to explain how diseases spread. And there's one portion of public health. The other portions of public health, indeed there are 10 roles of a public health physician. Let me touch on two of them. The first one and most important one is actually education. And the second one is creating public policy to reassure the public, not only during the outbreak times, but also during non-outbreak periods. And it's during this education period, Melissa, that I think is very crucial that we also consider the role of social media. There is an army of doctors and healthcare professionals of various specialities and training who are involved in social media right now, because that's where a lot of the conversation is taking place. So these doctors are, shall we say, playing the social media game, acting as auxiliary public health physicians and supporting the Ministry of Health in, creating a sense of calm and instilling a sense of confidence in the efforts of the Ministry of Health. So to go back to the original question, epidemiology is a small subset of public health, and it's a much broader set of team, including people working in social media.
Okay. Well, are these people working closely with governments? Because, you know, the role of governments during an outbreak often takes the upper hand. You know, they make the difficult decisions of how to allocate resources, when to call, for emergency responses. So talk to us a little bit about the dynamic between governments and public health officials.
Sure. Well, let me divide them into two groups, the government and the public health officials, as you have mentioned. Now, the public health sector in Malaysia employs almost all the public health professionals in Malaysia. As you might imagine, the private sector does not have a monetizing effect by hiring public health professionals. Therefore, a lot of the expertise lies within the Ministry of Health. So they're very integrated. There's a second group of public health physicians who work in the universities, and a third group who works in the NGO sector, civil society. They work for organizations, for example, that do environmental health as well as occupational health. Those are the three main groups of public health physicians in Malaysia. They therefore, because they are part of the Ministry of Health, the coordination becomes very easy because they are actually members of the machine. The group of doctors that I spoke about earlier, the ones who are on social media, they are actually either government doctors or doctors in the private sector, and they're very active. They have unofficial connections into the Ministry of Health. Also, they sit into some important panels during non-outbreak period where they're also coordinating the communication, public education elements of the Ministry of Health effort with a focus on social media. And that's what the public health physicians in Malaysia do as it relates to education, Melissa.
Okay.
Dr. Kaur, Malaysia joins a chorus of countries in trying to evacuate our fellow countrymen outside of the epicenter, which is in Wuhan, Hubei. And of course, this is in conjunction with doing things closely with the authorities in China. But many other countries are doing the same. We're talking about the UK, we're talking about Japan, Australia, a bunch of other countries are now pulling their countrymen out of Hubei and Wuhan. Is this a smart thing to do? Should we continue to observe and quarantine these individuals there? What would be some of the risks when we talk about in extracting and extricating these people out of the epicenter?
Ibrahim, that's an excellent question with answers that are always going to involve trade-offs. On one hand, the risks of bringing them back to Malaysia, let's assume the Malaysian citizens that we're going to bring them back to Malaysia, could be that they could be harboring the virus, they could be then transmitting the virus to Malaysians inside Malaysia. So that's the most first and most obvious risk. However, we can mitigate those risks by perhaps quarantining them and putting them inside a hospital, for example, for a period of 2 to 4 weeks. I say 2 to 4 because we still don't know how long the infectious period of the virus would be yet. So let me just use the term 2 to 4 as an example of what we can do as a period of quarantine. So we can, there's a risk of them bringing the disease, but we can quarantine them to see if they develop it. And if they do, we can find some way to treat them. So that's the health element. Ibrahim, there's also the political element. The political element in the sense that Malaysia, in the nation state of Malaysia and all the other 190 nation states in the world, we have a responsibility and a duty to protect our own citizens wherever they are in the world. So if a Malaysian citizen were to find themselves in China, we do have a moral and legal responsibility to evacuate the citizen to come back to Malaysia and care for the person in Malaysia. So I guess that's also the political angle with pros and cons. May I open a third and final element to it? Is the fact that this particular virus indeed is borderless. It has no passports. So when we think about whether or not we will evacuate a citizen from one country to another country, obviously there are geopolitical implications. Even if you leave that aside, it is the fact that we're not against any country, but rather this is our species, Homo sapiens, going against a virus that has been here for 2 billion years. So these are the three implications: the health implications, the political implications of our duty to care, as well as the geopolitical implications that this is not a fight between countries, but rather a fight between our species and the virus.
So if we were to use that point, Dr. Koh, then in response to a global outbreak like this, who calls the shots? Is it the WHO?
The short answer to that is they have a small portion of the shot. Of calling the shots, rather, the decision-making privileges. Most of the power and legitimacy in terms of public health responses reside at the nation-state level, in this case, Putrajaya. So Kementerian Kesihatan, or Ministry of Health, together with the National Security Council, and here's a bit of a small geeky note, National Security Council Directive Number 20 describes the powers of the National Security Council in Malaysia. So Deputy Prime Minister has chaired the National Security Council as it relates to this virus as well as the polio outbreak. So a lot of the power and legitimacy and decision-making privileges at the nation-state level simply because that's the way the world is set up. What WHO does is two things. Number one, they set standards for what is determined to be a safe and credible outbreak response. And number two, they will facilitate a little bit of a coordination. And in that coordination, they do two very specific things. Number one, is something called GOARN, or the Global Outbreak Alert Response Network. It's an organization set up based in Geneva. It coordinates the standards for outbreak responses from all around the world, also acts as a clearinghouse for information of data and science and facts. That's one thing that the World Health Organization would do. The second thing that the World Health Organization could do is to declare a public health emergency of international concern, PHEIC, Melissa, something that you mentioned earlier. So far, since 2009, or rather, the international health regulations allowed the creation of a PHEIC since 2005. So since 2005, in the last 15 years, we've declared 5 PHEICs, and one of them affected Malaysia, which was the H1N1 crisis in 2009. So in summary, the role of the World Health Organization is clear, but it's more standard setting and coordination, and the bulk of the responses and positions are at the nation-state level.
Right, I see. Well, you know, we have so many more questions for you, Dr. Koh, but unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this episode of Consider This. Thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your insights with us this evening. That's all the time we have on tonight's show. I'm Melissa Idris. With me, Ibrahim Saini. We will be back with you tomorrow night for another episode of Consider This. Thank you so much for watching and good night.